Thank you. Thank you so much. And what a pleasure it is to be here today. And what a pleasure it is to see all of you here today. It's just absolutely amazing. It's Elizabeth. It's her birthday on June the 9th. And mine is on... So this is an ongoing discussion. Anyway, let me thank you all for coming, and I hope you'll find the day interesting. It's got a number of different components in it, and different people speaking. And in a way, the very kind people who've said they'd like to come and say something spans most of my career. And so you'll hear a little bit about that. One of my interests has been meditation. And how many of you meditate? Oh, better do it in the negative. How many of you don't meditate? Okay, well, all make sure you learn. Because it's one of the most wonderful things you can do. And these are for all the people who meditate. I just want to know what your view is. Many people see colors in meditation. They're part of the siddhis. And the siddhis are something you ignore. But we're beginning to take an interest in these things now. And the appearance of colors are important in terms of your own progress in the meditation. This comes from James Austin, who's written a book on Zen and meditation. And I thought that what I would do is just ask how many of you see these colors. Now, if you look here, this is the visual field. This is people who do Zen meditation and cast their eyes down. But in other forms of meditation, I find it's true too. This is the top eyelid, which is just open slightly down there. And then in the visual field appears a color. And certainly I'd agree with Jim that purple is a common one. And then as you progress, you may find greens, and greens going up onto the left. The left is significant because the left is the right hemisphere. So this essentially is both hemispheres, which goes across to the right hemisphere. And if you look at the pinks, they go up onto the left side or the right hemisphere. Now, how many of you have seen colors like this in your meditation? Yeah, it's quite common, isn't it? So mainly we don't speak about it because we've all been taught that you don't speak about the phenomena because you only then name it, and that stops it from happening so much. So it's there for you, and I'll be interested, and I'll ask you afterwards how many of you in fact have seen colors today now that you're aware of it. And the argument is that it's the color part of the visual cortex which changes during meditation. And you'll note that it's going over to the left, which means that it's the right side of the brain which is becoming dominant. And maybe we'll have more about that today. Okay, so I'm going to light the candle, and then we'll have about 10 minutes meditation. Martin will bring us out of the meditation with some music, and then we'll start on the day. And of course, you all know that you have to do your meditation early in the morning. How many of you meditated this morning? Do better. So if you'd all balance yourselves and go into your meditation posture, that'll be a silent meditation. Well, thank you so much. A beautifully quiet meditation. I now have great pleasure in introducing my very dear friend, David Lorimer, who's been with me in the network right since 1983. a really long time, and he was director of the network, and he now edits the Network Review, and he does over 150 reviews in it of books that he's read. David, former director of the network, now is on the board and edits Network Review. Most amazing guy. 150 books he reviews every year. Could any of you do that? And of course, I suspected he cheated and just spun it through like that, but that's not true. Because when he, when I looked at the books, they're all underlined and annotated. He's an amazing guy, David.
Thank you so much, Peter. Well, thank you. And I'd just like to add my own welcome to everybody here. And I was looking through the list earlier in the week of who was coming, and it was so wonderful to see all of your names on the list, and people who hadn't been at network meetings for a while, and then lots of people who've come along for the first time, which is fantastic. Anyway, as Peter said, we've known each other for over 30 years, and I'm reminded of an occasion where my friend Serge Beddington-Behrens, who's here today, and I, we chaired the 80th birthday celebrations for Sir George Trevelyan, which were at Imperial College. And I have to say, we had to stop George speaking, because those of you who remember him will know that once you got going, he was totally unstoppable. And he was very indignant to be stopped at his own conference, you know, that he'd been got going. Anyway, that was a great celebration as well. And so you've all come to celebrate Peter and Elizabeth, and they are such a strong team together. That's almost unimaginable to think of them without, you know, the team that they form, especially with all the books they've written together. So neuroscientist, neuropsychiatrist, mystic and meditator, as you've just heard, friend, and lover of gadgets. If you know Peter, you know he loves gadgets, and he always has the latest gadget, of whatever it is, measuring energy, for instance, except his Zion, which is a gadget that most of you will have sort of gone on to smartphones, you know, quite some time ago. But Peter is still going on with his Zion. He's got about four or five of them, I think. And they all duplicate each other, so all your dresses and everything are in there. And then he was involved at a very early stage, as some of you know, in doing EEGs of the Beatles, with interest in meditation in the 1960s. And I think he'd quite like to be auctioned those at Christie's, probably. So I can imagine that the EEGs of the Beatles in the 1960s must be worth a fortune. Family man. It's wonderful that his family is here in force. Natasha and Tristan have actually flown in from Boston and Tokyo, respectively, to be here. And Annabelle is here with her son, Hugh, who is about to go to Exeter University to study medicine and then keeping up the family tradition. And then I should also mention that another of the grandsons, Sebastian, is currently in a Zen monastery. And when Elizabeth mentioned this to me, at the end of the email, it said, "Guess whose influence this was?" And I know that he's got his eye on Hugh as well, for sort of teaching and meditation, because I heard him last night talking about it, and say, "No, I'm sure he'll join." The Peter as the family man is a hugely important part of his life, and some of you will know that they all have this amazing gathering in Inverness in the summer when they're all there in force. And everybody converges, and there's a wonderful photograph in their dining room of them all. It must have been a year or two ago, and so this family life is incredibly important to him. He's been a member of the network since 1977, and so one of the very senior members of the network. And as you know, he's devoted his life really to a science of consciousness, to developing a science of consciousness. And I mean this in two different senses. One is the neuroscience of consciousness, what you might call the harder science of consciousness, the objective science of consciousness. But also he's been developing with meditation the qualitative, subjective side of consciousness. So consciousness within science, but also science within consciousness. And so this is really, this I think is the leitmotif of Peter's career, which then has taken him into, as you know, near-death experiences and after-death experiences and the whole area of ending life experiences, in which he's coined the term ELE, an end-of-life experience. And we've been involved in this as well for over 30 years with IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and you'll hear more about that later. And then another very important aspect of Peter is his interest in meditation and non-duality, and you'll hear more about that in a moment. And Peter's also been hugely made a huge contribution as a chairman of various organizations, including here at Collett House. And I was just hearing about the effect of his chairmanship here, which was really wonderful to hear. And I remember he used to, in the Scientific and Medical Network Council, he said that chairing this meeting is like herding cats. They're trying to get people to agree with each other and trying to keep the meeting on time as well. But he's also chaired with me Mystics and Scientists for many years, Beyond the Brain for many years, and various other conferences, including our May Dialogues. And I have to remind Peter of an embarrassing moment when, in 1988, we were having the May Dialogues, and Mei Wan Ho, he introduced as Mei West. And he didn't just do it once, he did it twice. It was a great moment. I don't know whether Mei Wan was flattered. But he always says that at the end of chairing a meeting, those of you will know this, that he says, well, what's the one thing I can take away from the meeting? And he always comes up with a gem of what he's going to be able to take away from the meeting, and he may do that again today later on when we get towards the end. He's also been with me organizing symposia at Cawdor Castle for the last 20 years, and it's a great sorrow that Angelica Cawdor couldn't be with us today. She's in Paris at an event that she couldn't change. Otherwise, she'd certainly have been here. And so this is another thing that Peter and I have been doing together. He's also done a great deal of work with the Prince of Wales's Foundation for Integrated Medicine. And this is another where he was the chairman of trustees. And not to mention all his research and scientific papers. But I just want to finish with just a few kind of more personal reflections, just in terms of what I associate with Peter. One thing is his care and compassion. He's a doctor through and through. And I'm sure all of you would agree, if you wanted to be cared by somebody, then being cared for by Peter, a wonderfully caring person, you couldn't think of anyone better to be cared for by. Then I'd like to mention his clarity of mind, and that he brings great clarity of mind to everything that he undertakes and gets involved in. Then his enormous tact and sensitivity, which is part of his care, I think, because he's very aware of the effect of other people's of other people's feelings of all the situations. There's great sense of empathy, and also his courage, because he has been trying to balance the scientific and the spiritual, the orthodox and the more heretical, throughout his career. And it takes an enormous amount of courage to stand up for against their very powerful prevailing trends, and be you may hear a bit more about St. Peter and also Rupert, who has this same moral courage. And it's very important in breaking new ground. You can't be a pioneer without having moral courage. And the last thing I'd like to mention is fun. And it's always fun to be with Peter and Elizabeth. And they always look on the bright side. They're always positive. And if you go and stay in their house, you're made most welcome. Made me a cup of tea this morning. And at 7 o'clock, he's always up with a cup of tea. That's part of the care and the service, as it were. And so I'm sure you'll recognize all these things that I've been saying about Peter and Elizabeth and the strength of their team and their family together. And it only remains for me to say that I can't think of anybody better, as Peter would often say at a conference, to talk about his own scientific and spiritual journey than Dr. Peter Fenwick.
David, thank you so much. I didn't recognize that guy at all. When David gave me this title, I thought that I would actually speak to it. I don't always speak to the titles I'm given, but I thought I would today. And so, yes, the title was My Scientific and Spiritual Journey, so I will do just that. And if you're thinking of a spiritual journey, then the most important thing is, what is the person built on? What does he carry, really, from early childhood? Well, my mother was a surgeon. She was one of the first women surgeons in Australia. And she came to England and did her FRCS in Edinburgh at a time when women just did not behave like that. So she was cutting her own ground, really. And my father was a farmer in Africa. He was a coffee farmer. And this was wonderful because it imbued in me the feeling of freedom, because you could wander in the coffee and you'd have to have a very good sense of direction, otherwise you wouldn't know how to get back. So I developed a very good sense of direction. The other point is it was incredibly beautiful. We could walk out of our house in the morning and there would be the sun rising beside Mount Kenya, way in the distance. So again, it's the expanse of nature, and the feeling of freedom. And this was carried out or continued, really, in everything you did. And the unity of nature going through the parks as a young child and seeing it was really very important. Of course, Amboseli, which is close to Nairobi, which we used to go to, and you could see Mount Kenya, Mount Kilimanjaro. And can you see the amount of snow it has? Yep. So it's a slide from long ago. And it was always a target for Kenya boys to climb. And did I climb it? Well, of course, because I was a Kenya boy. I had to. But did I get to the very top? No, because I got mountain sick. But at any rate, there it is. And those of you who've been watching the BBC will have seen it. So it's this idea for freedom and the beauty and the harmony of nature, which has always been important. I was sent to school in the Rift Valley. And the school was exactly on the equator, and this is the equator sign. And again, it was absolutely beautiful because you could just lie in the school grounds and look out across the Rift Valley. And what you see there is Longonot Crater. And I've always wanted to climb Longonot Crater. I never have, and I expect I may never. I don't know. But it's a beautiful crater and wonderful expanse of nature. The school, well, it's like any British prep school transferred to Africa. Very little difference. There you see the boys. Do look at their socks with bands on them. And if they had their hats, you had bands around the hats. And so you were always tagged as a boy from Pembroke House. This was where we did one of our first physics experiments. I'm standing on a bridge, or the person who took this photograph is standing on a bridge, and you'll see a railway line. Now, the bridge linked the school to the sports ground, so everybody went over it every day. And there was a train which used to come down 3 or 4 times a day with a huge, great engine, wooden fired, so it got a great big heavy tender in front of it. And we started by putting 10-cent pieces on the line to see how they'd squash them. And that was fine, it did that very nicely. Then the more adventurous people started going to small stones, and it managed to crush those very nicely. And then one day, one of the boys decided he would put a rock on the line to see how it went. Now, the unfortunate thing was that at that particular day, it wasn't the engine that was first, it was a rather light truck. And we all saw this light truck coming first. And I must say, I shut my eyes. And it, in fact, pushed it out of the way. And people who were there, I think they were just exaggerating, said the truck jumped off the rail but landed back on it again. But that told me something about experimentation. You must actually understand the limits of the experiment if you're going to do it safely. I then came to the UK, to Stowe, where I went to school, and this was a beautiful place. I mean, again, it sort of echoed the freedom and beauty of Kenya, and you're allowed to experiment and do things there. And I made my first television set by the age of 16. It was black and green. Probably none of you remember the old radar tubes, which were black and green. It used an old radar tube. And from Stowe, I went on to Trinity. And there I was so fortunate. I mean, I've been so lucky. If I was to design a life for myself, I'd design this one, I think. Because Lord Adrian, a Nobel laureate, was master. And Lord Adrian was interested in the electrical rhythms of the brain. And so already I was beginning to learn about how the electrical rhythms of the brain worked. And the next person is Andrew Huxley. So Andrew Huxley, another Nobel laureate, who defined the mechanics of the neural membrane, or the mathematics of it. And then Willie Rushton. Loved colour vision. He was one of the professors of physiology, and he'd grab us when he could and put us in his wretched machine and measure how our cones and rods responded to various colours. So I learned quite a lot about experiments there. When I was at Cambridge, I had another teacher who arose, and she has been an extremely good teacher throughout my life. In fact, this is a picture of the Ngong Hills in Kenya, and I walked her up to the top of it and then asked her if she'd like to marry me, and she's never replied. she says because she was breathless. any rate, she started writing manuals for me, and the first manual she wrote was this. And in case I didn't get the point, she wrote that one. And then to make absolutely certain that I was there, she then wrote that one. And in fact, she's been highly successful, because there are 9 grandchildren now. And very nice to have Hugh with us here, and very nice to have our own children here, who David told you had come specially for the occasion. So, a highly successful teacher. I went to St. Thomas's and worked with Mr. Harvey Jackson. He was a neurosurgeon there. And I'd always wanted to do neurosurgery, but I realized that you stand for a very long time in those days in operating theater, and you don't see much about the brain. So I decided it had to be mind, but mind and brain. And so that led me into psychiatry. David was talking about the establishment. I was interested in the intensive care unit later on when I was a consultant there. And so I went to their ethics committee and said, I'd like to do a study on people in the intensive care unit. And they said, yes, okay, what's it going to be? And I said, it's going to be asking them questions, whether they were conscious in the intensive care unit when they had their period of unconsciousness. And it was fascinating because the guy who ran the unit stood up, said, this is never to be, because none of my patients will experience anything when they're unconscious. And I was denied permission, and it took, in fact, about another 5 to 6 years before I managed to get it through. Then on to the Maudsley Hospital, and again, that was the premier psychiatric teaching hospital, and the lead psychiatrist was Dennis Hill, Sir Dennis Hill. And he was an amazing man. He was really interested in the rhythms of the brain, so the EEG, which I'd become interested in, obviously, and epilepsy and the mind. And so I ran the epilepsy unit there for a long while. And he was also important in putting in every psychiatric hospital an EEG machine. And you used to go to some of these psychiatric hospitals in the provinces, and they'd say, look, we've been delivered this. And they would reverently unwrap their EEG machine. I don't think any of them ever got them to work, but they were all there for them. And then Broadmoor Hospital, because I ran a unit there, and that told me something about criminality and the relationship between brain function and the acts that we do. And it's the whole question of whether we have agency, whether we don't have agency. And so that was a very important part of what I did. Now, in the earlier part of my life, the key breakthrough moment, the first breakthrough moment which led to the search was this one, where I met, rather I came across this book published, in fact, in 1956 by Colin Wilson, The Outsider. How many of you have read The Outsider? Oh, it's quite a good group of you. And I'm sure you'll agree that coming to this in a naive fashion and learning about the idea of a transcendent reality which interfaced with this reality we're in now was enormously influential. What was this reality? Obviously very creative, and creative people had it. And the next one was this one, Cosmic Consciousness by Buck, a psychiatrist from Canada. And here, again, it was more of the same thing, but it was, in fact, talking about the fact that people could actually attain this transcendent state. And so not only was there transcendence, but you were able to attain it in some way. So that was important. And that led to this one, the finding of a school. And this, you've all seen these adverts on the tube, Philosophy Today, go along to the School of Economic Science and learn your philosophy. And I thought, yeah, it'd be rather nice. And Elizabeth was there, and I said, fancy a course in philosophy? And she said, no, I fancy a course in pottery. And so I said, yeah, okay, well, that's fair enough. Why don't we do philosophy for a term and then we'll do pottery? And she was very accommodating. And we still have yet to do our term of pottery. But I'm sure it will happen sometime. And that, of course, brought me here to the Study Society. And I liked it very much because of the people and the influences in it, one of which was it respected science. So you could actually talk about the sorts of things that I was interested in, like meditation and science. The school, you'll hear more about later, was basically, Gurdjieff was an influence in the school, but he broke with Mr. Uspensky, who founded the school and this house. And I was highly enthused by a new model of the universe. It's something quite new. I hadn't really come across ideas that there could be a scientific formulation of the sorts of things which I was interested in philosophy. And also another book of his called Tertium Organum, which is the first canon of thought, no, sorry, the third canon of court of thought, a key to the enigma of the world. And so if you want to look up the enigma of the world, as seen by Spensky, you can do it in Tertium Organum. But heading this unit was Dr. Francis Rowles, and Spensky always said there was a piece missing. Dr. Francis Rowles met the Shankaracharya, and the meditation was one of the missing pieces. And so that's where I started meditating, and I was initiated in 1966, and I really liked it. I mean, I just took to it. It was sort of natural for me. But you can't talk about it, well, you couldn't then. One had to sort of be very covert, A, that you, well, you never told your colleagues you meditated, that would have been death and destruction. Could do studies on it, but as long as it was a scientific study, it was held at arm's length, that was okay. So by 69, I'd done several studies on meditators. I'd taken some from the TM movement and some from here. And the results showed that there was definite cerebral rhythms which correlated with the meditative state. And rather more interesting than that, there was changes in oxygen consumption and CO2 consumption. Now that was really important because if you could get a technique which dropped the metabolic rate right down below the basal level, then it would be something really amazing. And there was a letter in The Lancet at that time which talked about yogis which were put into holes and covered up. And they always survived, and the question is, how could they? And somebody said, well, it could be the CO2 in some way protects them as it builds up in the hole. So they put CO2 absorbers in, and they very nearly ended up with dead yogis. So it got something to do with CO2. At any rate, this early study from Harvard claimed that you could drop your basal metabolic rate. And we did a study on this, and it showed that, in fact, you couldn't. It was really just an artifact of the way that they were measuring things. But nevertheless, meditation was very powerful in other ways. David has mentioned this one. It was fascinating. I wrote to the Beatles and said, I hear that you've been meditating with the Maharishi. We're studying meditation. Would you like to come along and let me record your EEGs? And I got a letter back from George Harrison, and he said, yep. And on the day appointed, I got a panicked call from the front porter, who said, there's a man here dressed very strangely. He's in a big car. Shall I send him away? And I said, no, I'll come and get him. And so George came and meditated for us. But of course, if you were leading that sort of life, he was extremely tired, so you know what's going to happen, don't you? He sat down and closed his eyes. He actually did a little chunk of meditation like this, and then he went to sleep. So then you have this really difficult question. You've got a sleeping beetle there. What are you going to do? You're going to wake up and say, you're not meditating, you're sleeping. Or do you just let him sleep on? Well, I reckon he was a tired beetle, so I let him sleep on. And then woke him up and said, how was that? He said, very refreshed. And I said, do you think you went to sleep? Absolutely not. Meditation all the time. But we got enough of his record to see, in fact, that he showed the same sort of changes in meditation that we'd been finding in other people, but it was really nice. And as David said, that was to be my pension, you see. George Harrison's EEG record, it would have about 100 pages in it. Just imagine, you could sell that at Christie's. But no, it wasn't to be, because somebody nicked it and his signature, so I don't have it here for you. There were many false trails in my search to find out people who had special skills. And I'm not going to go into them all. I'll just tell you one story. This was Divine Mother. She lived in a flat in Kensington. She was very, very well built and sat on a on a sofa, and all her courtiers were in front of her. And I came in, and she, first of all, slagged off the Maharishi, who hadn't got quite the divine qualities that she had, she told me. So, but she said, on the other hand, that she was a healer, a very powerful healer. So I said, okay, well, let's test it. So I said, how is she with epilepsy? Oh, it's no problem, she said, absolutely none. And so I said, okay, well, I'll give you three people with epilepsy if you would like to cure them. And she said she would. So I talked to the Epilepsy Association, and I got three people who said they would like to have their epilepsy cured by Divine Mother. And what they had to do was get chilies, which they bought in the market, and bring them to Divine Mother, who then vibrated them with our hands like that. And every morning they had to put the chilies in their room and look at her photograph, and their epilepsy would go. Well, I'm afraid their epilepsy didn't change very much. And so I went back to Divine Mother and said, I don't think the chilies are working. And she said, don't worry. Ask everybody to come here, and I'll cure them. And I said, okay. So I asked the people if they would like to go and be cured by Divine Mother, but none of us were expected anything, and that's exactly what we got, nothing. We were total shambles. That actually was a very good lesson, because Divine Mother clearly didn't have that sort of healing ability to cure epilepsy. But there were amazing teachers I came across, and one of the most important teachers is this lady, Mother Mira. How many of you have seen Mother Mira? Yeah, not all of you. You look into her eyes in her darshan, and it's very powerful. So I think she has a really high level of consciousness. She's worth seeing. And if I was a publicity agent for Mira, I'd tell you that she's going to be here later this month in the UK. Working with meditation as far as science was concerned was actually very important. And in order to get a better understanding of the mental states of people in meditation, I thought that I ought to study transcendence more. And you remember, it goes back to Colin Wilson. Then I came across this lovely woman, Thetis Blacker. She was amazing. We met at a dinner party, and I had this rather naive habit of saying, had any good transcendent experiences recently? And Thetis said, yes, why? And so I videotaped her, and I collected at that period a number of people who had very deep transcendent experiences. And the thing about Thetis was that she put into her meditation the experiences that she had, or a modification of the experiences she had in her transcendent state. Many of you in the network will have seen Thetis describing her state. But we had an agreement together, and that was that the one who died first would let the other know that they're going to die. And I thought that would be interesting. I'm sure Thetis would like to know what it was like if I was going to die, but I was much more interested in what it was Thetis would experience when she was going to die. And unfortunately, she was the first one on the block. And she rang me up and she said, I think probably I'm close to my last week or so. Would you like to come and see me and talk to me? And I was in Japan, so I couldn't. But I could, in fact, talk to her on the phone. And her description was absolutely magnificent. She said, I'm in the room now, and there's rivers of golden light passing through the room. And the golden light is composed of love and compassion, peace and calmness. And that was really then, two or three days later, she died with these lovely rivers of golden light passing through her room. Now, that actually was enormously important to me, because I thought, okay, what this is saying is that you may move towards a transcendent state as you die. And if you do, is it part of the dying process? So it's obvious then that the transcendent state is available, and there is a lot about that in the literature, and it's the question of the veil which limits our perception. And this was described by William James and others. Where did it come from, and what was its natures, and how could we change it? So those were the sorts of questions that I had. And at about that time, I came across Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life and the NDE. Now remember, we're going back to the late 1970s, early 80s. And when I read his book, I knew that NDEs were absolutely fictitious. They were Californian, weren't they? It's what you did in California. They'd never crossed the Atlantic. And so you can imagine how surprised I was when into my consulting room came somebody who'd had an NDE. He got his because of what was going on at St. Mary's Hospital. He had a failed cardiac catheter and had a cardiac arrest. And so I had to take these seriously now. And in 87, I did a film for the BBC, and very kindly they asked me to present it. And this was on the NDE. It was a QED program. And we got 2,000 letters following that. And so that allowed me to... We took 500 of these, and David was very much involved with this because we were with IRONS at the time, International Study of Near-Death Experiences. So we looked at these letters, and we chose the deepest experiences, and I got a repetitive sample after I'd sent a questionnaire out to them. And then Elizabeth and I wrote The Truth in the Light, which is really an account of over 350 of these cases. And that showed me something really, really interesting, and that was that the NDE can occur to anyone at any time. It's not something which only occurs when you're unconscious or only when you're dying. It can occur at any time. So it's a common mental, it's not a common, but it's a mental state which can be easily accessed. And so it seemed to me that there was a very thin veil between us and reality. But this reality clearly had different levels, and it could be assessed smoothly and easily, as shown by the experience reported during the EDE, the NDE. But was this only a creation of the brain? So this became absolutely central. Is this something that the brain creates, or in fact, are we talking about a veil that you have to try and penetrate and go beyond? Was it actually a glimpse of a reality beyond? Well, if you ask that sort of question, you can look at brain function and ask if there are systems which will do this. But I was wanting a rather more dramatic view, and so I was looking for outliers in abnormal mental states which would allow one to do this. And of course, cardiac arrest, NDEs, with no brain function was a prime target, because if there's no brain function, then of course you would, and you still get it, then you have to argue you're talking about the transcendence. And the next set of outliers is when consciousness loosens and separates the veil, which is dissolving. And do you remember Thetis and her rivers of gold and compassion and love? This would suggest the veil gets very thin at that point, and people go into the transcendent. Now, was that true or not? Well, we did a study with Sue Brain, and you'll be hearing more from Sue, and Ineke Kodam in Holland, and Hilary Lovelace in this country. And we collected, and I talked about the results of the study on the radio and on television, and we collected over 1,500 accounts, and that's written up in this book. And so what you immediately see is that dying is a very special process. It's not what we think it is. It's quite different. And that really, this puts it all together in the sense that premonitions start the dying process in some people, deathbed visions. And then this is most interesting. It's a new reality that the dying go into. And what is the new reality? Well, it's the reality which I was talking to you about. It is, in fact, full of light, love, consciousness, spiritual beings and dead relatives. It's an amazing reality. And they go into it and come back and go into it and come back. So you can see exactly what Thetis was doing. She was, in fact, accessing this reality. There's something here called terminal lucidity, which I won't talk about. And this new reality, the question is, how common is it? Is it just people like Thetis, or is it other people as well? And the answer to that is it's very, very common. And in fact, transcendence phenomena is present in nearly 80 to 90% of the dying. So this is what you guys are all going to experience as you die. So you want a good manual and you want to learn about it before you do it. So how do we access this reality and what constructs it? Well, this reality, of course, is constructed by our perception. So there's something really interesting about perception. And what is it about perception that leads to us being kept away from this reality on a day-to-day basis? Now, you're just going to have to put up with this because I can't do it simply and easily. And you must forgive me. We're going to talk about, which I hope Martin will be doing later, the subject-object split. First point is you are perceivers. So just accept that for the moment. You perceive things. I think you'll agree with that when you're conscious. The perceiver uses his mind wrongly. We all use it wrongly. And because it has a narrative self, we have this little voice within us which keeps telling us things. And they're all fictitious. They're not right. And we go by it. It tells us these lovely stories. Tomorrow is going to be a sunny day. Well, come on. We live in England. It leads to a feeling of agency. And in other words, this little voice can do things. Can it? And that, of course, is now a huge scientific debate, just from a mechanistic point of view. This leads to a thick veil of belief and habit. And that's really what keeps the veil thick and screens us. You're often trapped both in the future and the past, but you know this, and you're not in the present moment, so you suffer from frustration, sadness, etc. Now, there is, in fact, a form of knowing which is called non-symbolic consciousness, and this is just the perceiver and only perception. It's quite different. There is no or very limited storyteller. The mind is quiet. The world is underpinned by profound happiness. Do you remember Thetis with her rivers of gold? And you see this in all transcendent states, profound happiness. Each moment arises, stays, and falls. There's no agency and no self. Now just imagine that you weren't doing things all the time. Well, in non-symbolic logic, you don't do anything. There is the arising of the moment and the falling of it. Perception in the advanced stages of a pure energy form, and you move, and this was one of the reasons for my interest in colors in meditation, you move from physical forms into energy forms, and colors are very common in many meditative states. Non-local mind is manifest. I didn't stress this with the dying, but as the dying died, a lot of non-local phenomena occurred. And so it's manifest particularly in non-symbolic consciousness. This is what is classically referred to in the literature as being awakened. Okay, well, does it really exist is the first question. And so I've got Rupert Sparrer here, who claims an awakening, and so you'll want to put a question or two to him, won't you, if I can get this machine to work.
Hi, could you give me your name?
Rupert Spire.
Rupert, thank you for coming along today. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the changes that have occurred to you. How do you experience reality now? How do you experience the world now?
My only knowledge of the world now is the current perception. In fact, I don't really know a world now. I simply know the current perception. And if I look to that perception and ask what is its substance, all I know is the experience of perceiving. I don't know a world out there that is perceived. I just know the experience of perceiving. And if I ask myself, what is the relationship of myself to this experience of perceiving, I find that they are utterly, intimately one and the same. I can't separate myself, and by myself I mean whatever this aware, knowing presence that I am is. If I ask myself, what is the relationship of myself, this knowing presence, to perceiving, that there is no relationship, there are not two things, but there is just the experience of perceiving. In other words, there is not an inside self, the perceiver, and an outside world, the perceived. These two, the subject and object, are only existent in imagination. They are non-existent as such, in other words, as they are normally conceived to be. And what remains is just perceiving, which is a modulation of my own being, of this presence of awareness, this knowing presence. So there is an experience of complete intimacy with all seeing things. And this intimacy, this lack of separation or otherness, is what is known as love. It's the absence of any kind of distance or otherness in experience.
Okay, well, there's lots more on that. And so I'm going to just now end with telling you about one of my latest experiments. The awakened state seems to have its own physiology. And so when meditating, the awakened can enter into a multidimensional field of pure love. Now, what on earth does that mean? Very advanced meditators produce a high gamma activity in their EEG, and the Dalai Lama has produced one or two such meditators for the American scientists that he works with to study their brain waves, and you get very high gamma activity. Now, the only other person I've seen producing gamma activity like this is Alain Fourget, and he's interesting because if you are here and you look into his eyes, and you will see light. The light is amazing. It fills the whole room. It transforms the whole room. There are a lot of characteristics and qualities to it. And the question is this imagination? No, it's not. Does the light have special qualities? Yes, it does. And can one take this further? And I think the answer to that is yes, one can. I put him in an MRI scanner, and this showed that he has in his brain a special area in the temporal lobe which really gets active when he's meditating. But I want to show you these graphs if you can see them. This is the normal frequency profile of the EEG. It's flat. And when he meditates, this is the profile, and I'll just draw it out for you. He gets this very, very high gamma activity. And if you look at his brain, these are pictures of his brain, you can see the gamma activity is arising on the back. And this shows you that it goes on at many different frequencies. So it's a very unusual rhythm which he produces. So, okay, that hasn't taken things much further than Americans and the Dalai Lama's one, except that these people do occur and can be studied. But the interesting thing for me is, how does the person who's receiving the light change? Does he get changes in his brain waves? And is his brain being modified in some way? So here's both of them doing it together. And in the control condition, there is no response in the person who's receiving the light. But if you look at this, you can't see it probably at the back. He, in fact, is producing high gamma activity, but not as high as Fourier, in his own brain. So looking into the eyes of somebody and receiving the power, the energy, whatever word you like, will modify yourself. So, in summary, the narrative self is encased in the brain and body. There's no doubt about that. And perception is innate to the human condition. Removal of the narrative self reveals multidimensional energy structures. And this is exactly what the awakened describe. But you get to it by removing the narrative self. And when you do that, the universe is perceived as love. Well, guys, can you all go and remove your narrative self? Yes, if you work hard enough at it, you can. But you don't have to work all that hard, because there are now just beginning courses where people work for 2 to 3 months, and they claim, but I haven't seen any of them, so I don't know, that they've awakened. So just imagine what would happen if that was actually true, that I came back to this room in, say, 3 months' time, and you'd all awaken. Wow. That would be remarkable. Okay, so has my search been successful? So far, so good. But it won't be complete unless I awaken too. Let's meet again when I'm 90.